Across the UK and around the world on webcast and podcast, my name is Howard Hughes and this is The Unexplained. And thank you very much for all the emails you've sent into this show since the first podcast. And I do apologise, this second one has been so long coming. I promise you the next one won't be. We've just been sorting out logistics here of how to record it and setting up and all kinds of other stuff that I won't bother you with now. Thank you to Martin for the great new theme tune. Martin, thank you for that. I know you're going to be listening to this. I said I'd use it and here it is. So we've got a new theme tune. There it is. We'll let you hear it in full at the end of the show, I think, just so you can get used to it. On this show, we've got quite a lot of UK material this time round, and one American. The UK material, we're going to be talking about ghosts. I'll be talking to the founder, the boss of an organisation called Paranormal Tours in the UK, and we'll be getting into the things that they do. I'll also be going to the northeast of England to a group of people who very recently had an amazing encounter with a ghost, they say. And the photograph made the local papers up there. This organisation in the northeast is called Ghost Inspectors, but spectre is spelt as in ghost, S-P-E-C-T-R-E. So I'll talk to him about that. I'll talk to a man who's got some theories about the way the oil market works and about the things we're told about it that may not be true, and also some chilling predictions about exactly what is going to kick off, he thinks, in Iran towards the end of this year and into next year. I'll be talking to Simon Bacon, an up-and-coming medium who's getting a lot of press at the moment, and he was involved in a survey done by the Reader's Digest magazine just a little while ago that said effectively 3 out of 5 people in the UK now believe in psychic things, and many of those people think that they themselves have got psychic powers. Simon was connected with that research, and we'll be talking to him. But first up, let's go to the organisation Paranormal Tours in the UK, find out what they're all about and the kind of stuff they do and the experiences they have. Online to The Unexplained now should be one of the people who run that company, Andrew Marcy. Andrew, hello.
Hello there, Howard.
Andrew, good to talk to you, and I wanted to get you on The Unexplained for a while when we were doing the radio show. You were on the list, we just never got around to you, but I'm glad we have now. What is Paranormal Tours? Tell me how it works.
Basically, Paranormal Tours, what we do is we organise paranormal investigations all over the country for those people that are interested in it and not too sure how to start out. So what we do is we book up locations that have got recent reports of activity, so that increases our chances of actually witnessing something. But we also make sure we guarantee absolutely nothing, which is a bit strange. But when we set people's expectations to see nothing or feel nothing, when they do get something, it's a bonus.
Okay, because a lot of organisations do these sort of tours, and they're walking tours, and, you know, guide will take you around and say, well, in this place, you know, a hooded man from the 17th century occasionally walks past, and at night time people hear clunks and clicks, but you don't work that way.
No, I mean, we try to use panel tours as an education for people that are interested in the paranormal, and interested in the, even if you're a sceptic, it's quite interesting to come along and see how we actually work. We base our investigations on two different levels. We base it on the spiritual level. So if you are that way inclined and you are quite sensitive to spirit people and energies, then it's a good sort of way of getting introduced and using your skills there. But also we have lots of scientific equipment that we use for the less sensitive people, the more sceptical people, so they can actually see the instruments working in conjunction with the medium or the spirit people that are around, basically tripping them up.
Now, from what we've seen from investigations on the TV and what we've read about, quite often, and as you said, you don't give any guarantees, but quite often phenomena may have been reported in a place, even recently, but at the time you go there, don't show. So, you know, what guarantees are there that there's going to be something happening? What, not guarantees, but, you know, what chances are there, I think is the way to put it.
Like I say, I mean, we say there's no guarantee of actually witnessing anything, but it's all about using the skills that we teach you throughout the night in trying to capture some phenomena. So we'll sit down with you and we'll show you how an EMF works, we'll show you how a negative ion detector works, we've got ultrasonic listening devices, and obviously the experiments that we can set up with triggered objects and things like that. So we do put a lot of things around and about that if anything does happen, hopefully, the spirit people that are around will actually make themselves known that way.
There have been quite a few media reports over the last year or so that I've followed about, you know, paranormal phenomena, ghosts exhibiting themselves in various places. I remember, I think there was a shoe shop in Cornwall or Devon last year that made all the national papers. Would you go to a place like that?
We have done for our own personal investigations, obviously for taking a large number of people. I mean, we normally take around about 24 clients along that are interested, and we split them into smaller teams. But it all depends on the size of the venue. But we do still do our own private personal investigations ourselves. So, I mean, we have been asked to go to certain places that I think we've had something moving in here, or the kettle keeps turning itself on, we think there's something about. So, yeah, we have been to like smaller establishments where they believe paranormal activity is taking place.
Tell me an example, give me a recent example of one real success, one place that you've staked out, you've had a group of people with you, and it really has worked.
Yeah, I mean, one place that we've been to recently was actually a private residence, somebody's house. They were moving house, and they lived there for about 6 years. And they've had lots of various phenomena happen. So they've been hearing footsteps in the middle of the night, feeling cold breath on their face. The children, the small children, have seen something, like they're gazing at something into thin air, which they weren't too sure about. So we actually got invited along to go and have a look. And we stayed. The good thing was the house was actually being emptied, so because they were moving. So we had pretty much free roam of the place, and set up trigger objects, and we had strange temperature fluctuations. Not necessarily. What we found was that the activity stopped when the family's daughter actually moved out of the house. So it was poltergeist activity connected to the family rather than poltergeist activity within the house. So that was quite interesting, seeing it stop when the girl had disappeared. So yeah, I mean, we have been to places there where we've actually done we've done rescue work and things like that with a medium. Something's happening there, and the spirit people are able to communicate to the medium.
When you talk about rescue work, just explain that to people who don't know what that is.
Okay. Basically, my interpretation of rescue work is a spirit person that is unfortunately trapped in a particular environment for one reason or another. There's no set way, that there's no real explanation of why that happens. But what happens is we go along to a place, the medium will connect in to the an environment that the spirit person is in, start some communication going, and hopefully they will be able to bring through their own spirit guides and take away this trapped energy, this trapped person. Now, it's quite interesting watching it, whether you're a believer or not, because sometimes some atmospheres that you go into, you can feel there is something quite negative there, not too sure what's going on. The medium will then start to connect in and start to help and rescue the trapped energy, and the atmosphere will just completely change. Temperature will start to go up for no apparent reason. When we've been sat in there for an hour before, temperature being a constant, say 20 degrees or whatever, and then when the medium says, oh yeah, they've gone now, and the temperature has risen to say 24, 25, which the temperature of the room should be. So we like to sort of, like I say, put a balance on any sort of spiritual activity and cross-checking it with any scientific findings as well.
How long have you been doing this for?
Okay, I've had a lifetime interest in the paranormal, like yourself, always interested in bits and pieces, but it's only maybe the last 4 or 5 years that I've really taken it serious. With the reduction of cost in prices of kit and things, that I've been able to go out and do proper, say, scientific investigations as well.
Well, I mean, that's a fact, isn't it? The electronics for this used to be really expensive, the kind of thing that only scientists could afford. But these days, you know, anybody can go to a shop like Maplin's, places like that, and buy gear that you can use.
Exactly, and it's more affordable. I mean, some of the kit that we use is specifically designed for paranormal investigations as well. It's got, I mean, for example, an EMS that we use. It's got a filter in for mains electricity so that it pulls that out of any sort of scientific readings that you're going to get. You're not going to pick up any mains electricity.
So that allows you to see whether the electromagnetic field in a place that you go to changes suddenly for no reason that can be explained.
Exactly. It filters out the electricity. I think it's 50 or 60 kilohertz. It pulls that range out of the analysis. So anything that does trip the EMF off is something that is actually fluctuating the EMF range rather than it being just an electric cable that you can't see.
You do this for a living, if I may say so, and, you know, has anything ever happened that's frightened you?
I've been quite fortunate in the way that I've never actually been so frightened that I've had to run away. I've been able to stand my ground, but one particular site, which always has fond memories in one way, is Coal House Fort in Essex. I was in there with a group of investigators, nice and quiet, just doing some baseline readings. And one of the guys was still stood in, there's a tunnel system there, and one of the guys was stood in the tunnel system. And he heard this strange sort of banging noise, and he called us over, and we stood in the corridor trying to listen to it. And this banging noise was getting closer and closer, and it wasn't as if it was in the atmosphere. It was very strange where it was coming from. We couldn't pinpoint it. Then all of a sudden, this ice-cold blast of air just rushed over our heads, and we sort of like looked at each other thinking, well, what was that? And then because there was no breeze in the tunnel at all. It was a completely still night. Then a blast of cold, icy air came from behind us as well, which we're thinking, well, that's a bit strange. But this noise was coming closer and closer as it was almost on top of us. And we just couldn't explain what it was. And the atmosphere was just changing to be very, very, very dense and very, very negative. And the guide of the fort, she has had no qualms about being in the tunnels or anything like that in the past. And she just got so freaked out that she said, I've got to leave. We went with her, went outside to try and find the source of this noise, whether it was something coming outside and echoing the tunnels. And I mean, this was like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and it was completely silent. We went into the tunnel system immediately after, around the other side where we thought the sounds were coming from, and it was completely silent. So we have no way of knowing what that noise was. I'm not saying necessarily it's paranormal, but it was something that was there that we couldn't explain. It was quite an interesting thing, and what we actually captured on our film footage, which we didn't see at the time, which we've got on our website, is a ghostly image or some sort of white mist appearing from the background and rushing towards us. And we don't really know what it is. We've had people have a look at it, and you can actually make out a figure jumping towards us, but we're not too sure exactly what that is. But that was a particularly interesting night.
Exploring like that is one thing, and you know, I find it fascinating, and I would certainly go on something like that. One of the things that worried me a little bit on your website was that you said that you got involved in exorcisms. You know, that would make a lot of people a little worried, a little frightened, actually.
Well, we don't necessarily get in. I don't think there's anything on our website that says the word exorcism. But like I said earlier, we do work with very competent mediums that are able to do rescue work. Which some people link the two together. I mean, we don't go around with crosses and putting things on people's heads and things like that. That's just for the movies, as far as I'm concerned. But when we do go and do rescue work, that is a little bit different. And like I say, we will go to various locations, and if we do come across a trapped energy that is able to communicate with the medium and that would say, look, I really don't want to be here anymore, and the medium will pick up on their anxiety or they're unhappy, then they will ask them, well, do you want to move across? Do you want to move on and meet your family again and all this kind of thing? And like I say, from the temperature readings, from the EMF readings and things like that, and obviously yourself, because you're a very good instrument for paranormal investigations with yourself, you'll feel the atmosphere change, you'll feel the temperature change and that kind of thing. So now I wouldn't say that we did exorcisms as such, so I'll leave that to the movie.
Very wise. You never know what you're getting into. What's your website address if people want to see it?
Our website is www.paranormaltours.com.
All right, well, thank you very much, Andrew Marcy, for talking with us. Now, as I said at the top of the show, there's a guy in the northeast of England who got himself into the newspapers along with some of his ghost hunting colleagues because they took a photograph and found themselves, when they developed that photograph, have you heard this story before, with something that they couldn't explain. And his name is Darren Ritson. He's online now. Darren, how are you?
Not too bad at all, thank you very much. Not too bad.
Darren, listen, tell me about, what's it called, Ghost Inspectors?
Well, we're actually called the Northeast Ghost Inspectors. It's a little play on words. Obviously, ghost meaning ghost, spectres meaning spectres.
I think it's a great title. I found you on the internet, and I thought I've got to talk to this guy.
Yeah, it's a kind of name. We're pleased with that. I was actually thinking about rechanging it to just the Northeast Ghost Research Team. But I'm sort of torn.
No, you've got to keep inspectors. Inspectors stays in the mind. You've got to do that. Now, listen, are you a bunch of guys who all met down the pub and you thought you'd do this for a laugh, or are you seriously doing this?
No, we're seriously doing this. I've actually been into the paranormal for quite a long time. Can I just tell you a little bit about, like, myself and, like, how the team come around and stuff
Do it,
like
as
that.
They say in America, shoot.
Sorry?
As they say in America, shoot.
Well,
do
basically,
it.
the North... basically my team, the Northeast Ghost Inspectors, is we're a team dedicated to trying to find the truth behind ghosts and hauntings. I founded the team in May 2003 after a lifelong interest in the subject of ghosts. Ever since I was like a small boy growing up in St. Anthony's in Newcastle upon Tyne, I was always fascinated with the idea of ghosts. And after, at the age of 13, I actually experienced what I would consider to be full-on poltergeist activity whilst I was on a school trip to France.
What happened, Darren?
Well, basically, I had this huge oak cabinet, which was like, you know, like in my dormitories, and we'd smuggled up some orange juice and food into the dormitory, which we weren't really allowed to do.
Okay.
And I spilled some onto the nice wooden floor, and rather than clean it up, being a daft young lad, I thought, well, let's move this cabinet and we'll cover up the stain. So they got two or three of the lads to move it across, and we just left it there. Not thinking for 1 minute, if the teacher had come in, he would have said, well, what's that doing in the middle of the floor? You know, so basically, it got left there. And then through the night, I woke up to this like slow, continuous knocking. And when I opened my eyes, I was like, well, what could that be? And I was on these bunk beds. I was facing the wall. I opened my eyes. I turned round, swung my legs over the side of the bed. And I could see, you know, when your eyes get accustomed to the dark, I could see the cabinet, which had moved into the middle of the room. It was rocking from side to side.
God.
And it was like balancing on one side and then coming down to rest, and then balancing up on one side, coming down to rest. And then what happened, just astounded is, I mean, I was a young lad, and it scared me witless.
Well, I'd have been out the door so fast you wouldn't have seen my bum for steam, I have to say.
Well, basically what happened was, as I drew in to get a closer look, and rubbed my eyes, the thing actually took off, and it flew across the room. And all my contents inside, like my keys and my money and my bits and bobs, they just scattered around the whole room.
So, Darren, what on earth did you think was happening?
I really hadn't a clue. I jumped up, I put the light on. By then, I was frantic. I was crying. I was only 13. And the rest of the dormitory members, they were waking up and they were thinking, what on earth was that? Maybe they didn't use the word earth, but, you know, they were like, what the was that? And the rest of the night, we just spent sitting up. I was totally shaken by it. And luckily, that was my last night in France, and we came home after that. But it got us thinking, and after having a few strange experiences in my younger days, even younger than that, I thought to myself, well, there's something odd going on here.
Do you think you're a magnet for this kind of stuff? Do you think it's attracted to you?
No, not really. I just think I've been fortunate or unfortunate enough to have witnessed it. Depends on how you take it.
Because, you know, most people like me, I've been into this too, like you, for many years, but I've never actually experienced a ghost. I've never actually seen one. I've felt temperatures go down and things like that, but I've never had the things happen to me that happened to you.
Well, I guess I might have just been lucky. Either that, or it was destined for me to do this sort of stuff, really.
So you've got this bunch of investigators, and how do you work?
Well, basically, what we do is we sometimes get places by writing to them. You know, we apply to go to these places. We say, can we come and investigate your property, etc., etc. Other times, through like local media and things like that, they contact us. Sometimes, if the case arises, sometimes we get like private residences and houses where people think they've got something in the house, and what we'll do is we'll go along, we'll have a look, and we'll do a few tests and experiments. But 9 times out of 10, usually it's cranky floorboards or there is a rational explanation, you know. Very few and far between where we actually come across a good haunted house.
But the reason I found you and the reason I called you first off was because I just found you randomly on the internet, and apparently you took some photograph in a location you went to check out and then found there was something on that photograph, and it's in the local paper there. A couple of weeks back.
Yes, that was in Newcastle, Keep Newcastle upon Tyne. Basically, it was a charity investigation I was running, because a lot of the time I do a lot of work for the Children's Heart Unit Fund, which is based up here in Newcastle. What we'll do is we'll get a bunch of investigators together, and we'll do some of the local favourite haunts, so to speak. And then we'll get people in, we'll have raffles, we'll do this, we'll do that. And it's a bit of a fundraising night, but again, it's a serious investigation as well on the same respect. It's just every now and again we do the charity ones. Most of the time we do like the serious investigations. So basically, we'd went into Newcastle Keep to do the investigation.
Now, what is Newcastle Keep? It looks to me on the photograph like a castle. Is that right?
It's actually the keep of what used to be the old castle.
Okay.
What stands there now is just basically what's left of what they used to be. Obviously, it was built in the 12th century, which was built, well, I think it's about 800-900 years old. It's got to be one of the oldest buildings, well, in the country, never mind just Newcastle. It's now on maybe 900 to 1,000 years old, possibly.
So you went there to do this investigation for a good cause.
We went there to raise some money. Sorry?
And what happened?
And basically, well, we split up into our groups and we'd done our investigations and, you know, what we'd do is we'd split up into teams and we'd cover this area and then we'd cover that area and then we'd come back and reconvene and then we'd have a break and then we'd go back into the area. So what happened, what actually done is I'd assigned four, not of my team members, but four people who were there. I put them in a team and said, right, I'd like you to investigate the gallery section, which is up on the top. It's like four walkways which go right around the top of the keep, which is a big square, and it overlooks the Great Hall. And basically when they were up there, they were grouped together, and one of the guys was taking just general photographs of the area. And what happened was afterwards, he actually, you know, having a look at his photographs, and what actually did happen was he did actually notice something on the viewfinder. Then it was downloaded onto the one of the guy's laptops, and then we had a look at it, and then we found this figure was actually standing at the bottom of the corridor.
Now, the astonishing thing about the figure is it is your literal dark, shadowy figure, but it's pretty detailed, and, you know, for those of us who are a bit sceptical about these things, it looks like a fake. It's too good.
Yeah. We're having that debate at the minute. The picture's found its way onto a few other websites, and there's a very healthy debate going on about it at the minute, and which is to be expected. I'm rather pleased the fact that people do think it's too good to be true, because we actually know the true conditions upon which that photograph was taken.
And there is no way that it could be some other image from something else you'd taken that had crept onto there, like the old days with film, those things used to happen, didn't it?
No, I would say that's a very slim chance, or more or less impossible, to be honest with, because when the guy went in, his memory card had been blanked. Like, we always start by blanking my memory card.
So did you do some research as to who it might have been?
Well, there's a guy in Newcastle Keep. He's the actual warden and the curator, called Paul MacDonald. He's the best guy for the job, and he's actually undertaking that task as we speak. He's actually looking through... See, he's got access to tons of paperwork, which we wouldn't normally be allowed to get. With him being the curator.
So he's going to go through the records. Listen, you have to keep in touch with me because I want to know what happens with this story and the other stuff you do. Darren, it's a pleasure talking to you. This is just like an introduction to you, I think. The team is called, what, the Ghost Inspectors?
The Northeast Ghost Inspectors.
Have you got a website?
Unfortunately not. Although we've had the team for about 3 years, I'm relatively new to the PC scene.
Got to get one.
I'm busy working on one, but it's... slowly but surely, what with the new baby and me work full
and
time.
All that and stuff. But I guess if you do what I did and put your names into a search engine, that picture will come up because it was featured in some of your local media.
Yes. Yes, I would put in, if you're going to look in the search engine, I would put in Newcastle Keep Ghost Caught on Picture or something like that.
And it'll come up, I'm sure, like a shot. Darren, it's a pleasure to talk to you, my friend. Please keep in touch with us. This show's called The Unexplained, and our website is www.theunexplained.tv. Now, completely different subject. We've talked on this show about conspiracy theories and other things like this, and I've talked recently to a man who fascinated me. His name is Jerome Corsi. Jerry Corsi, he's known to his friends. And he's got some very interesting ideas, A, about the way the oil market works, but also about stuff that might be coming down the track to all of us from Iran towards the end of this year. Here's what he told me.
I'm a political scientist by training, and I have an excellent scientific background, including in statistics. I taught statistics at the college level. And I came at this subject through the politics of oil, really finding out and looking to see that people were arguing around the world we were at peak oil, that oil was going to run out. It was fossil fuel. There were only so many fossils, so there could only be so much fuel. And I got into the subject really going back when I was a child in the 50s. I remember reading the old scientific digests, which showed the Soviets were finding oil, you know, down 8,000 kilometers below the surface of the Earth. And I thought, even as a child, there couldn't be any dinosaurs that far below the surface of the Earth. So it's a subject that's intrigued me for decades. And I decided to write about it in Black Gold Stranglehold, really studying Iran, my previous book, Atomic Iran, and the politics of oil, and realizing that the United States was becoming increasingly dependent upon foreign nations, and that we needed to break the stranglehold because it was ultimately going to impact our economy and our foreign policy.
But Jerry, how is that possible? Because if we look at the situation here in the UK, and of course we too are tied into that whole oil dimension as you talk about, but also in this country, of necessity, we're having to get, for example, our gas supplies, which we depend on a lot here in the UK, from Russia. You know, Russia, I wouldn't consider to be as stable a country as the UK, not these days, not yet. And isn't it just the same situation that this is part of globalization? Increasingly, countries become dependent one upon the other.
Well, it is, and, you know, but at the same time, if you take a look at the United States, we're now importing oil from Canada, Mexico, and Venezuela. Now, in Canada, Canada has oil in the oil sands up in Alberta, Canada. That resource runs all the way down into the Rocky Mountains. And we have abundant oil shale, which at $70 a barrel can be converted economically into oil, just as the Canadians are converting the oil sands into oil.
So, look, if the U.S., I understand what you're saying, if the U.S. is buying in oil from other places but doesn't need to, why is that happening?
Well, because I think we allowed our environmentalists and the oil companies to do the same thing together, and that is restrict supply. The environmentalists don't want anyone drilling for oil or natural gas. And, of course, the oil companies, if they can convince us around the world that oil and natural gas come from dinosaurs or ancient forests, they can convince us all that we're going to run out of it, and they can charge more for it. But there's increasing evidence that the abiotic theory is correct, and that oil and natural gas are abundant at deeper levels than before we were able to economically drill. I mean, just look at the space probe that we landed, NASA landed on Titan. Titan, the great moon of Saturn, is abundant in methane. And it's been demonstrated to be abiotic methane, carbon 13. Of course, the alternative was, I guess NASA could have said there were a lot of little dinosaurs running around on Titan that produced the oil.
I guess they might. Now look, if this is the case, then this is a huge conspiracy theory, bigger than the conspiracy theories that they're talking about to do with 9/11, as big as the conspiracy theories that people talk about to do with there being a certain number of families who control everything over and above our governments. This is a conspiracy so large that it's one that it would seem difficult to get out of. How would you?
Well, I think it's more of a shift in scientific paradigms, like Thomas Kuhn described. In his discussion of scientific revolutions. You know, it's similar to the idea that all the planets revolve around the Earth and the Sun revolves around the Earth. That has to give way when new evidence is produced. And the idea that dinosaurs created oil comes from the 1700s, a Russian scientist named Lomonosov, and even Mendeleev, about a contemporary, who invented the periodic chart, another Russian scientist, said that it was nonsense that oil came from dinosaurs. The Earth combines hydrogen and carbon naturally, and, you know, the Nazis knew how to make oil out of coal, and they did it through the Fischer-Tropsch process, and, you know, step 43 in the Fischer-Tropsch process didn't say, here, throw in dinosaur parts. I mean, it's nonsense when you think about it seriously, and if you take a look at even our Department of Energy's website, they have a Deep Trek project. And they're making it clear that there's abundant methane in the United States, that's natural gas, under 3 miles. The oil that Mexico is getting and that we're getting out of the Gulf of Mexico goes down, you know, 7-8 miles below the surface of the water. So we're getting deep earth oil and natural gas today that I would say 2 decades ago, oil geologists didn't even know existed.
So let's just back up here now and summarize what we've said so far, because it's pretty amazing stuff. You're saying that there is much more oil in the world than we could ever imagine, we ever thought of before, the ordinary person is aware of. It comes from a source that we are not being told that it comes from. It actually comes from somewhere else. And the reason that this is not common knowledge is because the oil companies don't want you to know that. Is that right?
Yes, that's basically it. I mean, it's ridiculous, Howard, to think that at the end of the Mesozoic era, all the dinosaurs herded to Saudi Arabia like elephants and died in a big heap. We've produced, and we show in Black Gold Stranglehold, the geological evidence that shows the bedrock under the Saudi oil fields is deeply fractured. And what you have is you've got oil that's forming in the mantle of the earth coming up through those bedrock cracks, and it's seeping and pooling in sedimentary rock. Now, you've got the same in the Yucatan, where Mexico's major well, the Cantarell, has been shown to be coincident with the great meteor, the comet, that at the end of the Mesozoic era hit the Yucatan, one that's reputed to have destroyed the dinosaurs. Well, again, the geological evidence is that the bed of the Gulf of Mexico is deeply fractured from that comet. And it's natural, then, that oil is going to come up and seep in the sedimentary rock at the bottom of the Gulf. The Gulf of Mexico appears to be abundant in oil. Some of our largest wells are now there, the Thunder Horse, which BP and ExxonMobil are drilling. And even Cuba wants to start drilling 45 miles off of Key West, together with the assistance of the communist Chinese, if you can believe it. So, you know, the problem is that people have been locked in this mindset that oil is fossil fuels, and the inherent logic of that mindset is that because there were only so many fossils, there can only be so much fuel. The truth is that our solar system, it appears, has abundant production of hydrocarbons, including methane, that the Earth does produce hydrocarbon structures, complex ones, that produce oil, and that the processes for producing oil are very well understood. In the United States, we know to produce oil out of waste materials, corn can produce ethanol, you can even use turkey parts to produce gasoline. All those questions, though, are just a matter of economics, and at $70 a barrel, it's going to make sense for the United States to do deep drilling in the Gulf where we can, underneath the continental United States for methane, which is abundant, to convert the shale oil in the Rocky Mountains to oil, and to drill in the Anwar. There's no reason we should be, you know, dependent upon foreign oil or running out of oil for hundreds of years to come with the amount of oil that we know is existent.
So what do we do? What's the next step? How do we get momentum to make this thing happen?
Well, I think part of the first step has been what I've been doing. I've been writing about it extensively. I published Black Gold Stranglehold. I'll probably write another book this year. I've been writing on humaneventsonline.com and worldnetdaily.com. If you search my name there, you'll see dozens of articles that I've written. We've shown that the Russians, with this abiotic theory, have become the second largest producer of oil and natural gas to Saudi Arabia. And at the end of World War II, the American geologists thought that Russia didn't have any oil. They just didn't look deep enough. You've similarly got a situation where the Russians right now are drilling in the bedrock, volcanic bedrock structures off of Vietnam, and they're producing in those waters off of Vietnam oil at deep levels. So it's there. I think our geologists need to merely look deeper, expand the technology, and the public needs to be aware that there's a different theory which would explain why there's so much oil in the world.
Now, if you accept that this is the case and there is oil in places we wouldn't have expected it, isn't that going to change the way that power, the balance of power, hangs in this world? Because at the moment we're dependent on certain countries for our oil because we believe they're the people who've got it. And if that isn't the case, then everything shifts around, doesn't it?
Well, I think you're right, Howard. I think this is one of those cases where a scientific shift in paradigms is going to impact politics. Because we're going to be able to find that places in the world we thought had no oil, it's just recently been found that there's oil in Afghanistan. Well, that's been an area that we thought didn't have any oil again, and we looked deeper, we found it. There's oil probably in every continent, and abundant oil. Right now, even the Energy Information Administration of the United States documents there's 1.28 trillion barrels of oil in proven reserves. However, that's more than ever in human history, despite the fact that we've doubled consumption worldwide of oil since 1970.
Now, Jerry, look, what you're saying seems to me to be possibly, I don't know, on one level, great news for right-wingers in the United States and around the world, because we're saying, actually, all these guys that we thought we were dependent on and being held over a barrel, literally an oil barrel, by all those Middle Eastern states, we don't have to be anymore. This doesn't have to be the way things are.
That's right. In fact, the United States has moved to where Saudi Arabia is our fourth or fifth importer of oil. We're getting oil from our neighbors. And I'm arguing, if we're getting them from our neighbors, we have access to those same resources in the United States. We can go into the Gulf, we can go into the Anwar in Alaska, we can use the shale oil in Colorado.
And what about us here in Europe?
Well, you've got the North Sea. In the North Sea, beyond where you've looked, back up in the areas around Norway, those are some of the most expanding areas of oil exploration in the world. So there's no need to think that just because you pumped out the North Sea, you're going to be without oil. There's other areas you can go look and you'll find it. The same with natural gas. Natural gas bubbles up out of the mid-Atlantic crack, the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Again, abiotic methane, carbon-13, natural gas, and that comes from deep within the earth. There's no little dinosaurs down under the Atlantic decaying that produce that methane. It's just nonsense. Scientists, one of the Harvard Nobel Prize chemists just did research where he was able to synthesize methane in a laboratory, and he used iron sulfate, calcium carbonate, and water. He did a diamond anvil experiment at temperatures that resemble and pressures that resemble the mantle of the earth. And again, he didn't throw any ancient forest parts, no dead dinosaurs. Howard, when you think about it, I've buried a lot of people in my life. I never worried that a single one of them would turn into oil. Matt Murtha is going to be diesel number two pretty soon. We better line that casket.
So look, there's more fuel available potentially than we thought. What about the cost of producing it, though? Surely that will cause ructions and problems in all our economies, because finding your oil, producing your oil or your natural gas in a different way is surely going to cost more.
Well, I don't think we're going to go back to $20 a barrel again anytime near soon. But there's no reason that we have to just have an upward increase in oil and natural gas prices. If you take a look, you can see the technology has advanced dramatically. The deep sea drilling and the deep earth exploration today is the most advanced and really the fastest growing technology in the oil and natural gas industries. All around the world, oil companies have learned to go deeper. And that has produced new sources of oil and natural gas that before were not imagined were there.
Which all sounds very positive. Something else that you talk about, and something else that intrigued me when I heard you speaking on U.S. radio, was your theory about Iran and what's going on there.
Well, I think Iran, the book I wrote on Iran, Atomic Iran, you've got Ahmadinejad, who's the president of Iran, and he is a radical zealot. He believes in this Shiite theory that there is a lost imam, a lost holy man, the Mahdi, the 12th imam, who as a boy went down a well in Karbala, in a mosque in Karbala, in Qom, Iran. He went down that well and went into reclusion, into hiding. And according to Ahmadinejad and this theory, the lost imam, the Mahdi, is going to return, kind of like a second coming of Jesus Christ in the evangelical Christian belief. When this Mahdi returns, it's going to bring about a worldwide triumph of Shiite Islam. Now, this is not nonsense in terms of Ahmadinejad believing it. He referred to the Mahdi when he spoke to the United Nations in September last year, when he announced that Iran had developed the ability to make uranium-235, to do enriched uranium. He also referred to the imminent coming of the Mahdi. Now, the one difference in the Shiite belief and the Christian belief is that Ahmadinejad believes that an apocalypse has to occur before the Mahdi returns.
And that's why we need, you say, in the West to be concerned about what's going on with Iran's nuclear program.
That's right, because Iran has a history of lying about the program, talking in order to prolong things.
But isn't it true that Iran only in the last week or so has said we wouldn't throw out the idea of some international consortium running our nuclear program for us, so you can all take a look at it and you can see that it's perfectly straight?
Iran, the Persians invented the game of chess, and they're great at counter moves and these different strategies. I'll believe Ahmadinejad the day he shuts down Isfahan and Natanz, Isfahan where he's processing uranium into uranium hexafluoride gas, and Natanz, where he's taking the uranium hexafluoride gas and enriching it to uranium-235.
Now, we've got a problem here, haven't we, United States and America, because we took on Saddam Hussein because we believed he had weapons of mass destruction. We find that, unless they were very well hidden and have yet to be found, he didn't have those weapons of mass destruction. We've got rid of him. We've created all kinds of problems, global terrorism, which, yes, was already there, but may well be worse now. There's a division between the United States and the UK now. Blair, not popular in the UK because of what happened. Now we're saying, actually, here is something that's very serious. We need to get to grips with Iran and what it's doing with its nuclear program. Problem is, after what happened in Iraq, people are not going to listen, are they?
Well, it's going to be very difficult. There's no question about it. Even the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, has documented repeatedly that Iran has lied and hidden aspects of their nuclear weapons program. We've found many, many aspects of that program, and Iran continues to lie about it. The difference here is that, you know, Ahmadinejad has proclaimed that Israel needs to be wiped off the map. He's talking just like Hitler. And Israel is a one-bomb state. One nuclear weapon exploded over Tel Aviv, even a low-yield nuclear weapon, gun-type, simple uranium device like we exploded it at Hiroshima. That would destroy Israel as a modern state that we know today.
But the conventional wisdom is that that's never going to happen because Israel would respond very forcefully, would not stay its hand as perhaps it did in the first Gulf War, would just get in there, get involved, and smack Iran very hard, and that's why Iran won't do it.
Well, even Rafsanjani, the previous president, had said, or two presidents earlier, to Ahmadinejad, Rafsanjani has said things like, well, we could take millions of losses in the Islamic world from a nuclear conflagration as long as, in the process, Israel was destroyed, because there's only, you know, so many millions of Jews in Israel, but there's a billion Muslims in the world. Now, when you begin calculating,
but that's assuming
like
that all the Muslims in the world are going to want to do this, and there are an awful lot of Muslims in this country, you know, 99.99%, I would assume, who don't want to be involved in that kind of thing. So how can that be so?
Well, it's very simple. Let's have Ahmadinejad quit talking about the Mahdi coming back and an apocalypse needed to create it. Let's have Ahmadinejad shut down Natanz. We'll give Anna Isfahan, we'll give them the fuel he needs for nuclear power. The world will do that. Let's have him quit talking about wiping Israel off the face of the earth and firing his Shahab 3 when Prime Minister Olmert comes to visit with President Bush, demonstrating their capability to hit Israel very effectively, and the timing of that being a threatening move. As long as Iran continues to posture threateningly, they're not going to be very reassuring or convincing to the Israelis whose ultimate existence depends upon this game of nuclear chicken.
All this stuff reads very interestingly in the papers. I mean, we read about it over here in the UK every single day. I'm sure you do too. But for most of us, I think, over here, it doesn't seem real. It's the kind of thing that's never going to happen. Are you telling us that it is more likely than perhaps we think it is?
I think unless Iran can be stopped, you can guarantee that there'll be nuclear war soon in the Middle East.
And when you say soon, how soon?
Well, I think they'll have the ability. My predictions have been right. I said it would take them 4 months to be able to produce uranium hexafluoride gas at Isfahan after they opened it. That happened. I said it would take them 4 months at Natanz to be able to produce uranium-235. That happened. Saying now that they're going to move into Natanz 3,000 highly advanced centrifuges, more advanced than the P2, and that they will, it'll take them 3 months to do that, and that 5 months after that, somewhere around the end of this year, the beginning of next, they'll be able to announce from Iran that they have the ability to make uranium-235 weapons-grade concentration, to be able to do it in mass quantities. When that happens, they've had multiple teams of scientists working on this simultaneously. We know the Shahab-3 is now solid fuel, very reliable. We know also that the warhead of the Shahab-3 has been modified to take a nuclear device, and that Iran has studied and has the documents for metallizing the uranium that they produce, the uranium-235, so that they could make a weapon out of it. I'm saying that any time at the end of this year, beginning of next, from then on, Israel is going to get increasingly nervous, and the chances of a preemptive strike from Israel increase day by day.
This is all frightening stuff, and it's a patchwork of evidence, you say, that all adds up to this thing sooner than most of us realize is going to be the case. Now, problem is that people may well support Bush there, although his support is declining. Here in the UK, Tony Blair's support is declining because of our involvement in Iraq. There is very strong feeling, lots of demonstrations over here. He's under pressure. Word is he might go sooner rather than later. So how would we ever get an international consensus to do something about this, assuming it were true?
Well, in Atomic Iran, I predicted, and I hate to say these predictions are coming true, and I wrote about it then, I continue to, I have no confidence that the world will be able to stop Iran. I think the move to take Iran before the United Nations will fail. You've got Russia now. Russia has just sold $1 billion of a missile defense system to Iran that they're going to put around their nuclear establishments. China just did a $100 billion oil and natural gas deal with Iran. Russia and China are both on the Security Council. They'll never vote sanctions. The United States is stumbling before the Security Council, even with John Bolton there. We're making no progress. And I think Iran will continue to make fools out of the Bush administration and Tony Blair, because as long as you're talking to them, they're going to win. They're masters at this.
But what else can we do? We can't steam in there and deal with them, can we? What can we do?
You could impose sanctions. The world could impose sanctions like was done against South Africa. But again,
South Africa got round sanctions. South Africa existed for decades with sanctions in place.
Yes, but ultimately, when the financial sanctions hit the Rand, South Africa ended apartheid. And right now you've got Dubai, the Iranian mullahs, who are, I've always argued, a criminal mafia. I mean, they've stolen millions and billions of dollars from Iran. You've got $300 billion to $400 billion moved from Iran into Dubai in the last 18 months. The mullahs have built lavish vacation homes, resorts for themselves. That's their escape hideaway and their bank account. Meanwhile, the people of Iran suffer in near poverty, and Ahmadinejad has not distributed, as he promised in his campaign, the oil wealth to the people.
Now, there's another factor in this, and we don't have many minutes to get into it, but I find this fascinating, something that hasn't really been talked about too much in this country, but this is the idea that the Iranians not only will think about nuclear war and being an aggressive state in that way, but will try and undermine the economy of the United States.
No question about it. They understand the politics of oil warfare. Even Osama bin Laden has written about that. You're going to find that they're going to be able to try to keep the price of oil high and engage in oil extortion. And Iran is going to be very good at utilizing these techniques. They also work hand-in-hand with terror groups. Look at our 9/11 Commission report on page 240 and 241. The Mosul terrorists from the 9/11 attack got into the United States by Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda working together, and they got brought in through Iran. Hezbollah was created by Iran in Lebanon and funded by Iran, as Iran is now funding Hamas. Once Iran has the capability to produce a nuclear weapon, which I'm saying is soon, there's no assurance that they will not give it to a terrorist group like Al-Qaeda or Hezbollah or Hamas and seek to have a nuclear 9/11 occur in the United States or in the Middle East or in Europe.
So they're maximizing their chances, you say again, of getting the result they want.
It's a terrorist regime. They're supporting and funding right now Hamas and Hezbollah. They declared that they think they're at a historical point, Ahmadinejad does, where it may just be possible to eradicate the Jews from Israel and get Israel from the Middle East.
But meantime, and back to the economic thing, you say that the Iranians are starting to work on a plan to trade oil, not in dollars, which the world trades oil in at the moment, but in euros.
They've created a bourse, which is going to go operational. They're supporting this move to not only trade oil in euro, but hold foreign exchange currencies in euro. And I've written that Saddam Hussein really signed his death warrant when he got the United Nations to agree that he could do the same in the oil for food program and even hold Iraqi reserves in euros, oil reserves in euros. The United States is very dependent upon foreign exchange markets buying back our treasury debt and allowing us to redeem the dollars that they're holding in foreign exchange currency. If a big move gets started, and Iran is at the forefront of it, to hold foreign exchange currency and oil trading dollars, not in dollars but in euro, That's going to be economic warfare against the United States, and we're very aware of it here in the United States.
And looked at from the perspective of over here, if one thing makes the United States want to intervene in some way against Iran, that's going to, because that hits right at the pocketbook of every American.
It's a major trigger, and Iran is pushing that button every time they get a chance.
Well, Jerry, I found everything that you've had to say fascinating. These things don't get discussed, whatever you might think of them in this country, as much as perhaps they ought. Have you got a website where people can just go to take a look at what you're saying?
No, they can, no, not a website, but they can take a look at the books. If they go to Amazon.com, the books are under my name, Jerome Corsi, C-O-R-S-I, and you can look up both Atomic Iran and Black Gold Stranglehold. They can be ordered from the UK.
Jerry Corsi, we'll talk again, and thank you for that. This is The Unexplained with Howard Hughes, coming to you around the world on the internet. Now, in the last week or so, there's been a survey for the Reader's Digest magazine, says effectively 6 out of 10 British people, and you know that the British have a reputation for being very sceptical about things, but 6 out of 10 British people in 2006 believe in psychic things. Now, one of the people quoted in the article by the Reader's Digest about this survey was the medium Simon Bacon, and I know that he goes along with this. I've been speaking to him, and this is what he had to say.
The word psychic is a bit strange. Psychic means soul, really, literally. So it's to do with sensitivity, feeling and sensing the environment around us and ourselves more clearly. Maybe not just objective effects, but things like premonitions, dreams, clairvoyance, having visions, having feelings, hearing voices even.
And do you think it's a case of, I don't know, these days people feel more able to speak out about this stuff? And as you say, perhaps it's always been happening, but a lot of people will tell you, well, funnily enough, do you know, I thought that was going to happen, and then it did. A lot of people say that.
A lot of people do, and I mean, it's true, and absolutely, you're right. I think people are much more likely to say something now, and people are being asked about things. I mean, for example, with near-death experiences, there, you know, in the last 25 years, there's been lots of research on NDEs, and basically, people weren't asked if they had one 25 years ago, but now they are, and we're realizing that people do have, in fact, 40 to 60% of people who are flatlined have an NDE. So, you know, it's the fact they've been asked helps, and that's what we're doing. Now we're beginning to ask and see, so people are becoming more aware of it.
Well, you talked about NDEs. There was some research a few weeks back, not sure if you saw it, but some experts said that it's all perfectly explainable. It's to do with chemical changes in the brain, and that's why people think they've had near-death experiences where they've gone to somewhere else and encountered other things, and in fact they haven't.
No, I mean, that's one explanation, but it's not plausible because there is evidence and research of people that have been flatlined and they've had no EEG activity. Their brain has been switched off, their breathing has been switched off, for example, in operations, and yet they remember conversation, they remember special instruments that are used in the operation at the beginning, the middle, or the end. So if there's no chemical activity in the brain, how does that explain it with the ketone theory of hallucinations?
Now, look, you've been in this business for a few years now. I'm sorry for calling it a business, but you know what I'm saying.
Mm.
In that line, what is the most convincing story that you personally have ever heard? Can you think of one that's really swayed you to believe that those things exist?
Well, I've had a number of stories, Harry. I've had a personal experience where I've actually seen physical objects move in my room, things being moved without me touching them, independently, and you know, you can, it's a personal experience, but it's true. And in my work as a medium giving people readings, I often give people information that I don't know and they don't know, and yet it happens, and I get that validation later on from them, and it changes people's lives because it makes them think, well, wait a minute, how did it happen? Maybe this is meant to be.
Maybe I'm representative, I don't know what I am, but I'll tell you quickly a story that happened to me, and it's just a quick one, and I'll tell you. My mother, as people who listen to this show, sadly died 8 weeks ago. And last weekend, I was up at my father's home in the Northwest, travelling back to London by train, and I decided to take some of the tapes, music tapes, that I used to make for her. She had about 70 or so of these tapes, and something told me to take one in particular. Yeah. Sitting on the train, playing the music, enjoying the music on the tape, and suddenly the music stops and my mother's voice appeared. And to cut a long story very short, it was a recording that she made 15 years ago for me. It was just talking about some work that I'd done. She'd recorded some radio stuff that I'd done up in the north. And I didn't know that she knew how to record like that. And you can imagine the shock that I got sitting on a Virgin train on a Saturday evening. And suddenly I hear my mother say,
absolutely,
hello.
What do you make of that?
Well, I don't think it's coincidence, Howard. I think it's your mother trying to communicate with you, giving you that evidence. And you know, the more we look for it, the more we see it. And that's what's beginning to happen.
But equally, you can put it round the other way, can't you, Simon? You have to be honest about this, that sometimes if you look for a thing, you will find it.
Well, that's true, but I think that's part of being open-minded, and that being a psychic, you have to be open-minded and allow this information to come in. If you block it, you won't get it. And there's nothing wrong with that.
How do you know that you are a psychic? How did you discover that you are?
Well, it's interesting because I'm actually quite rational and a little bit sceptical, so I've questioned everything I've done because I'm not going to do this work unless I really believe in it. I heard a voice when I was 9 years old, an objective voice, turned around and there was nobody there. And it was at a time when I was very upset and needed reassurance, and it had a profound effect on my feeling at the time. And it was like it wasn't an inner voice, it was like an objective voice talking to me, a man's voice. I then found out it was my grandfather who passed away, who died, so I didn't know. And then I started to look into this a bit more because it affected me in such a strong way. And I started to have visions and see things around people, particularly people who maybe were poorly or not very well. I could sense something like that with them. And then I would see spirit people, and visitations would happen to me, millions of other people.
They say, and I've read, that it's quite common for children to have those experiences first, presumably because children don't have the preconceptions that we all have as we grow up built in. They're more willing to accept.
That's right. It's partly because of preconceptions, but also because their sensitivity isn't blocked by their brain activity. We go to school, we start becoming more logical, more right-brained, if you like, and people lose that inner sensitivity, and we don't lose it if we use it all the time, but children have that openness, and they can see. A bit like animals, they're supposed to be very aware and psychic as well.
But the one people will always throw back to you about that is that children fantasise, don't they?
Well, they do fantasise, but then the evidence you get from some children is quite remarkable. It's certainly not a fantasy.
Go on, then.
Well, I've had the experience where somebody told me about their daughter, who, at the time, her mother... her grandmother died, and a few years later, on the same day of the passing, at the same time, the little girl was in the back of the car and said to Mummy, "Mummy, Big Grandma's with us now." And the mum just couldn't believe it, couldn't understand, got home, spoke to her mum and said, "Your mum's been in the back of the car with us. What you know, little one's seen her." And they looked at the calendar, and it was obviously the same day that she passed and the same time. And the little girl didn't really know the grandmother when she was a baby.
And that's more of a test, isn't it? If it's somebody that you don't know, then how can you be aware of it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, one reading I gave to a man once, I said that his grandfather was with him and in spirit, and he was with him, asking him to write and to develop himself. He was at a particularly low point in his life. He understood everything in the reading, and it really affected him. But the last point, I said, "I can see your grandfather sitting on the front of a car smoking a cigarette." And his face dropped because he said, "Well, my grandfather never smoked. I know that." And I said, "Well, I'm sorry, I'm going to give it to you, and you give what you get with this." He phoned me about 2 or 3 months later and went to visit an aunt. They lived in Germany, and she'd moved over to the UK. He went to visit her, and she got out some photographs of the family. And there it was, his grandfather, sitting on the front of a car smoking a cigarette. And then it clicked, and he remembered the reading, and he phoned me about it. And so then he started to write. And he wrote a story about his grandfather, and it was then a play that he wrote, and it's just changed his life.
Absolute pleasure to talk to medium Simon Bacon, and there you have it. That research for Reader's Digest that he was part of says that 3 out of 5 of us believe in psychic things, paranormal phenomena, and all the rest of it. That has to say something, doesn't it, about the way things are going in this country and around the world. Things that we wouldn't own up to believing in the past, perhaps we do now. You've always got to keep an open mind about it, and you've always got to realise that there are people there who don't do the things they say they can, and there are always things that are claimed to be phenomena that aren't. But over and above those, there are the things that you can't explain, that are literally unexplained. Now, if you want to email this show, always pleased to hear from you with your experiences. We'll try and get some of you on here. Thank you for the hundreds and hundreds of emails, especially from the iTunes section of things. Been really pleased with all of that, and I'm trying to reply to all of the emails. We'll get round to them as soon as I can. And the last thing I want to do before saying goodbye is to let you hear once again the theme tune that Martin made for me. Now, Martin just emailed me when I was doing the radio show out of the blue and said, "I can do you a theme tune." And I thought, okay, I'll hear this. He sent me it, and I said, OK, can you do this, this and this with it? And he sent me another version straight back that is the one you're about to hear. So this is going to be the new theme tune for this show, The Unexplained. And Martin, I know you're listening. Thank you very much. Until next time on The Unexplained, be safe, take care. My name is Howard Hughes, and I'll see you soon.